The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. We've got our big bag. It's not really a bag. It's a pile of papers of questions. We're going to dig into the answers as we always do. We're going to start with a Social Security question here in a moment and then hit our, I guess we don't have an official name for it, but I guess the hot new question of the week is as good a description of it as anything. So we'll dig into that, and then we'll dig back into our pile from, I think we're working on November, December at this point. So appreciate everybody tuning in to listen. If you've got your own questions you'd like to submit for the show, best way to do that be to send them directly to Jim's email, jim@jimhelps.com. Just make sure in the subject line you indicate you've got a question for the podcast. You can also go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form. You can submit questions that way as well. So welcome, Jim, to the Q&A show this week.
Thank you, Cowboy. Good to be here.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Welcome, Bugsy.
Bugsy, there you go.
To the I've had a couple people refer to me in emails already as Cowboy, so apparently people are enjoying the call sign alternatives.
It is sticking for you anyways, Cowboy.
Has anybody called you Bugsy yet?
I got called Bugs. It's Bugsy. Bugsy makes it sound more masculine than Bugs.
It does?
Yeah, Bugsy. That's like a gangster's name.
I know, but it was supposed to be Bugs like Bugs Bunny because you go down rabbit holes. You're the one who's mutated into Bugsy, just so you know.
I just think Bugsy is better than Bugs.
Okay. Well.
But anyways, folks, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show with Bugsy and Cowboy. The only retirement planners, I think, in the nation, Chris, who have been given call signs by a real-life fighter pilot.
That's probably true.
Well, if someone can prove that statement to be wrong, let us know. If there's another financial advisor out there who's been given a call sign by a real-life fighter pilot, let us know. All righty. But this is the Q&A. Uh-huh. The Q&A. We have a Q&A of the week, a question of the week, new question of the week, and we have Social Security. I'm trying to dig the Social Security one up. What the heck did I do with it? All right. Social Security one is relative new one as well, Chris, because it kind of had to do with an answer you just recently gave.
Okay.
And this is from someone in the fine state of, they don't put it on here, so I'm not quite sure what state they're in. They do sign, they do have their real name, but they sign it Georgette. It's from a woman, so we'll always protect her anonymity. And it begins, hello, Jim and Chris, otherwise known as Bugsy and Cowboy.
Did she say that or you?
No, that was me throwing that editorial in. Yes. This actually came out a couple of weeks ago, this email.
Before the Bugsy and Cowboy thing, yeah.
That came out last week, didn't it? Bugsy and Cowboy? I think that was last week. I can't remember, but I think it was last week.
Yeah.
Okay, hello, Jim and Chris. This question is a reference to the Social Security question discussed in your April 9th podcast regarding the forfeiture of Social Security funds if the individual dies prior to making a claim. And for those of you who don't remember or didn't listen to Chris answering that show, Chris was just pointing out the obvious. If you pay into Social Security and die before claiming and there's no one else eligible to claim under you, those dollars are gone. You don't get a refund. They're not they're not yours. And the gentleman who wrote the question was kind of the other way around. They had, I think it was their mother, had contributed in, but didn't have enough quarters to get benefits, and he was wondering if she could get that money back.
Right.
Okay. And you answered all that, and the short answer was no to both of those. Okay. So this person says, what if the individual was married? What if that individual was married? Does the forfeiture also apply to spousal benefits for their partner? Or is the spouse able to apply for Social Security for those benefits? Along with that, is there a time limit to make that claim by the spouse? I think they're talking survivor benefits, Chris, not spousal. So let me reread that with what I think they meant. If that individual is married, does the forfeiture also apply to survivor benefits for their partner? Or is the spouse able to apply to Social Security for those benefits? And is there a time limit? Then they give a backstory. My father-in-law died at age 57. He was the high wage earner and about 5 years younger than my mother-in-law. We were not aware of spousal benefits, and I think they also mean survivor benefits, Chris. We were not aware of spousal benefits, something we later learned from your podcasts. And we assumed because he passed, none of his Social Security funds would now be available. This happened quite a while ago, so I doubt we would change anything now. I just thought it would be good information for others to know. Sounds to me like it's possible the mother-in-law could be eligible for a benefit over the deceased husband, who died young, yes, 57, but was eligible for Social Security. What are your thoughts on
that?
All this?
And I think she said he was the high wage earner as well. So it's likely
he was
that
the high wage earner.
His benefit, even though he passed at 57, it was. It's likely that his benefit is larger than the currently surviving mother-in-law. So yes, there needs, if there's a you know, assumption that when someone passes, all benefits are lost, then no, that's counter to this whole idea of survivor benefits. The whole point of survivor benefits is a benefit that continues after you pass away. So as a surviving spouse, the mother-in-law in this particular case, hopefully, someone at Social Security did the comparison to see if her benefit or his benefit would have been larger. I don't know. Did it say when he passed away? At how long ago it was?
Just said at age 57.
Yeah, I don't know how long ago that was. So at 61 years old, because it says the mother-in-law was 4 years older, right? He was younger, so she was older. So she was 61 at the time of his passing, she's got to be...
He was 5 years younger than the mother-in-law.
Yeah, so her benefit, she's probably, I would think, if she went into Social Security, unless she hid the fact that she was married from them and they didn't pick it up automatically and she was allowed to just claim her own benefit, I would be shocked to discover that she this whole time has been receiving just her benefit. I think she's probably been receiving his benefit, but it's coming to her, to the mother-in-law. So I guess I would ask this listener to verify what exactly is going on, whose benefit is being collected, how old the mother-in-law is. Because if he was the high wage earner, the mother-in-law should have been collecting his survivor benefit this entire time, because it's almost for sure larger than hers. And it would be a real travesty if she's been missing out on these dollars this entire time. So what she's describing concerns me, but maybe she just doesn't have all the pieces put together in the story. So this would be a case where I would, It would have been fabulous in our old format where people could call in and we could ask them questions. But I'll try to follow up. If she doesn't reach out to me after hearing this answer, I'll try to get that email from you, Jim, and reach out to her to clarify exactly what's going on with the mother-in-law, because she absolutely was eligible to receive a survivor benefit, assuming they had been married for at least 9 months. I suspect that's probably the case. But that's all you have to be married in order for a survivorship benefit to flow to your surviving spouse. And so there is no forfeiture. The fact that he passed does not prevent her from in the future claiming a survivor benefit on his record. The only question becomes, whose was larger? And maybe we can find, if in fact she's been underpaid this whole time, let's pretend this happened a long, long, long time ago, and she's now in her 70s or 80s and collected the wrong lower benefit for this whole time. If we can find and point to a place where Social Security made a mistake, if it's their fault, they will fix it retroactively. If they gave a bad answer saying, oh, no, you're not eligible, when in fact she was, or they processed it incorrectly, if the error is theirs, they'll fix it. If there's something that your mother-in-law chose to do that, you know, caused the benefit she's receiving to be what it is, that's really not easy to undo if you're looking back very far at all. Usually anything older than 6 months, it's a done deal. But if it's Social Security's mistake, then there could be a windfall for her. But I think that's probably unlikely. I think she's probably been getting the survivor benefit this whole time. And so there's nothing to fix. But I'll reach out and make sure it's all good before we put this one to bed.
Perfect. All right. Well, that was kind of a boring Social Security question.
Not to this person.
Not to this person. Very important to that person, and I'm sure it is. But we're left hanging. So.
Oh yeah, it feels uncompleted.
It's uncompleted. That's the good way of putting it. Yes, it is definitely uncompleted.
So I'll give everybody an update when I figure out exactly what's going on here.
Okay. All righty. This is the new question of the week. I had several good ones to choose from. I thought this one would be okay. I could turn it into an EDU. We won't. It could apply, especially in these periods of market volatility and rising interest rates. This could be of interest to several of our listeners. So it begins, where is he from, first of all? Los Angeles. He calls himself George, in quotation marks, as always, gives his real name, and does say that he's from Los Angeles. Hello, Jim and Chris, or Bugsy and Cowboy will be accepted in the future. I'm a big fan of your show and mostly a DIYer. I really appreciate your in-depth discussion, and I very often agree with your perspectives. Very often agree. That means sometimes he doesn't.
That's okay, Jim.
Well, just wanted to point out the obvious to you in case you couldn't pick up on that. He said, I have listened to your past discussions on SPIAs, MIGAs, DIAs, and QLEX. Oh, my. Should I explain what all those are, or...
No, let's go into the question first.
Okay. They're types of annuities. If you're new and you didn't pick up on that, a SPIA, a MIGA, a DIA, and a QLAC are all types of annuities. He said, I've listened to your previous discussions on SPIAs, MIGAs, DIAs, and QLACs, but I have not heard much on fixed indexed annuities. So he has to be a relatively new listener, Chris, because I think it was last year we did a few shows on fixed indexed annuities. That was it the year before.
There's listeners that may not listen to every single show. Maybe he missed it. But definitely over the years, at times, I'd say on at least three or four occasions, we've talked extensively about fixed indexed annuities. Okay. FIAs, FIAs.
FIAs, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. He continues, I retired in 2021 at age 63. I have $7.1 million in a 401k. I have a small IRA and a small Roth as well. He doesn't give the dollar amounts in those accounts. Some maybe taxable brokerage accounts and a modest pension. Like many people, I find it a struggle on how to balance my investments between stocks, bonds, and secure investments due to low interest rates, as well as stock market volatility. In a rising interest rate environment, the value of bonds can also decrease, and the stock market volatility can be a concern in retirement due to current events, economic risk, and inflation risk. I have several buckets of deferred income, which I will use for withdrawals, and this can help lessen the impact from declines in the stock market. Let me kind of pause there, folks, with a little bit of what this gentleman is saying. And he's a retiree in 2021, folks, so relatively recent retiree, just about a year. And he's 63, so early in retirement, clearly, early 60s and early retiree. He's got about $1.7 million and a little other, but it can't be much, Chris, because he doesn't identify it. So let's just say he has about $1.7, $1.8 million, a little pension.
Oh, wait a minute. I thought you said $7.1 million.
Did I say 7.1 or 1.7?
Either I heard it totally wrong or you said it wrong, because I wrote down 7.1 and I'm thinking, he's got a lot of risk capacity. So why are we talking annuities? 1.7, that changes the whole context.
It's 1.7. If I said 7.1, folks,
and I admit
apologize.
I might have heard it wrong. Okay. So
it's
1.7 million in a 401k.
Okay. And what he's experiencing, folks, is very, very common. He's got market volatility. He has rising interest rates. He knows that's going to cause his fixed income bonds to go down. He wants to maintain some cash, but cash doesn't yield very much. He does say he has some quote-unquote buckets of deferred income. I'm guessing he has some type of deferred income payments that are going to continue for several years. He's calling them buckets, and this deferred income is coming into him, and it's helping him cover some of his expenses rather than taking withdrawals. That's how I read what he wrote, but it could be totally wrong.
Yeah.
He didn't give much info there. The picture I'm trying to paint, folks, his situation, very common. Nothing initially is jumping out at me. His concerns, very viable. Market volatility, rising interest rate volatility. And he didn't say it, but sequential risk. The riskiest time for retirees is day one of retirement. That's your most risky day. Each day after that gets a little bit less riskier than the previous day, because sequential risk is your greatest risk. I hate to keep using that word risk, but sequential risk, or the timing of losses in your investments. If you suffer those losses early in retirement, generally described as the first half, or has now led to be said the first 10 years of retirement, the first 10 or so years of retirement, suffering losses can devastate your portfolio. It could really make your retirement funding later in life difficult. Now, hopefully this listener has done his minimum dignity floor. He feels his Social Security and pension benefits maybe covers it. Or if not, he's positioning some of that $1.7 million he has in a 401k to help take care of his minimum dignity floor. We all know that. So let's just assume, Chris, he did that as well. So he continues, I want to get your thoughts on purchasing fixed indexed annuities for a modest portion of one's assets due to the safety of the principal, while sharing some of the upside in the Standard & Poor's 500 or other indexes. In future years, I may elect to purchase an income annuity, like a SPIA, and that, folks, stands for Single Premium Immediate Annuity. It's where you give the insurance company a bunch of money, and they give you an income stream for the rest of your life. It's literally the mirror opposite of life insurance, where you give the insurance company money every year, and they'll give you a boatload of money at your death. In a SPIA, total opposite. Mm-hmm. You give the insurance company a boatload of money, and they'll give you a little bit of money every year for the rest of your life, and you... you could earn, or get back rather, more than you gave them if you live long enough. Mm-hmm. Okay. In future years, I may elect for a SPIA, but concerns about low interest rates and the risk of making an investment in a SPIA but not living long enough to get the money out makes me want to wait to decide. Again, a typical, we call that, honestly, the annuity puzzle. Not we, Chris and I, but the industry calls it the annuity puzzle. Everybody wishes they had a pension, Chris. Everybody wishes they had lifetime guaranteed income. They look enviously on at retirees who do have a pension. But when push comes to shove to actually buy their own pension, they don't want to do it because they start crunching the numbers saying, well, what if I don't live long enough? What if I don't get all my money back out of it? I think when you have a pension through your employer and you don't keep track of all the money you put in it and all the money that the employer put in it over the years, and you're just getting an income stream out of it, mm-hmm. you're not doing the same calculation. But you should, because that same calculation is there if you wanted to add it all up. But when it comes to doing it on your own, they panic. It's called the annuity puzzle. So again, doesn't surprise me, folks. He's not looking to buy an income annuity right now. And he didn't share enough with us yet, Chris. I don't know if he needs an income annuity right now, if he has an income shortage or not right now on his minimum dignity
floor.
Well,
this is 63 for our process and our approach would almost certainly be too young
to buy one.
To be buying one anyway, because he's right in his delay period. The first annuity he should be trying to maximize is Social Security by delaying it, because that's going to buy him a better annuity than purchasing one. So that's the first thing that, you know, jumping it out at me is his age. So I think there is, I think he's right. There's no urgency to rushing out and buying an annuity.
Correct. So then you took this the way that I was going to take it. Let's assume, folks, he doesn't need the income annuity right now. Remember, he did say he has deferred income pools, buckets, buckets or pools? Buckets, several buckets of deferred income. I'm assuming this income he's living off of and helping him now. He doesn't say if he's turned on his Social Security yet, but maybe he's waiting to 70. Let's just assume for today's argument and discussion, he is waiting to 70. He's got 7 more years. I don't know how long his deferred income lasts. He may have a little bit of shortage during this delay period, Chris, for his minimum dignity floor. I don't know.
Might have a big shortage.
But with $1.7 million, I think he can cover it. Let's just assume, again, he can. He may need an income annuity, and he acknowledges that, folks. But most of the time, Chris and I see, at least in our practice with the typical client we work with, most will need to consider an annuity well into their late 70s to early 80s. 78 to 83-ish, somewhere in that 5-year period is when most people might need to consider one, some a little earlier, some a little later. So he has time. He's worried about the market. He's looking for some guarantees, some non-investment risk, and he's wondering if a fixed indexed annuity might be a viable option for him, and what do we think of it? As a reserve, I'm just thinking in my head where he could use something like this. If he is going to need an income annuity later, let's just say 83, folks, just making that up, he's 63, 20 years from now, you could take two approaches to this. Any money he reserves now, it could easily drop in the market, and he shouldn't panic and want that principal protection. He could easily say, I need this money in 20 years, at least that's what my analysis now shows, and I can take investment risk with it. But the money that I want to spend this year, next year, or even in 5 or 6 years, I want to be very careful with that money. So one would argue, no, you don't need a fixed indexed annuity for that. You don't need principal protection for something that's 20 years out. Although, maybe he's just tired, folks, of market volatility. He's getting attracted to something that is going to have the potential to earn more than bonds in a rising interest rate environment, because bonds will drop in principal value. if he wants that principal guarantee, and he does say in his email he likes that, that he's not going to lose the money he puts into that annuity, but the interest he's going to earn is going to be tied to an external index. Chris and I will explain that in a second. He'll get some growth on it, but he's not going to have to panic and worry. Who are we to say that's right or wrong? I think that's a personal decision. One could argue, Chris, in my opinion, either way. If that is what he's thinking of doing, I'm obviously writing a lot more into his email, but he acknowledges he may need an income annuity in the future. He doesn't want to buy it now. He wants to buy it later and consider it later. You could invest money that you're not going to need for 15 or 20 years in the markets, and you shouldn't panic now if it goes down. If anything, you should put more money in if it goes down. But if you're looking for a little bit of surety and guarantee and you're in your 60s and you're done with the volatility of markets, I could say, yeah, an equity or fixed indexed annuity could be a viable option in this case, Chris. And earmark it away and say that fixed indexed annuity, I'm never going to have to worry about it, and it's going to buy me additional income in the future. So I think it's fine either way. What I'm trying to get people to understand, an annuity purchase like this for principal protection is a personal decision. Because he does go on, Chris, and lists all the negatives. So he's got this nailed, folks. He's got all the negatives listed out of him doing this. He said, I understand there's downside. Fixed index annuities are complex. They're going to be taxed as regular income rather than capital gains. Now, I'll pause there. There are no capital gains in a fixed indexed annuity or any annuity except for a variable annuity, because they're not investments. A variable annuity is an investment. You're not buying a variable annuity is an insurance, is an investment in an insurance wrapper. A fixed indexed annuity has it right in the name, folks, fixed. It is a fixed annuity. Any fixed annuity is not an investment. Your principal is never at risk. The insurance company is going to guarantee your principal 100%. The only thing that's unknown in a fixed indexed annuity is how much interest you will earn. The insurance companies even call it interest. They call it interest credit. Mm-hmm. The IRS calls it interest credit. So, of course, it's not going to be treated as a capital gain, listener. The insurance company tells you in bold letters, this is not an investment. Your money is never invested in an index, and your money is never at market risk. So that's why you're not going to get capital gains treatments. It's not an investment. It's an insurance product. Okay, my little commercial. But he lists, here's all the negatives, and he nailed it. So he said, fixed index annuities are complex, taxed as normal income rather than capital gain. I have to commit my principal for 5 to 10 years before I can access it. There's credit risk of the issuing insurance company. And of course, all the sales pitches by the annuity salesman. So he's hit the nail in the head on that, especially the complexity part. These are extremely complex products. They're not easy to understand. The costs are going to be impossible for you to figure out, but they are embedded within them. You don't pay a commission like you do on some insurance products. All your money, all your money is fully invested into the annuity. But the quote-unquote cost is the yield spread. The insurance company is only going to give you a certain amount of interest tied to the performance of a certain index. He mentioned the S&P 500. And they get to keep everything else above that. That's called the yield spread, and that's your cost. If you buy them through a insurance broker, agent, or producer, the cost, if you will, or yield spread will be buried into the product, and it's difficult to see. If you buy them through a advisor channel, we talked about these before, they're called fee-based annuities. If you buy them through there, you will have the potential to get higher interest because the insurance company is not paying the advisor like they pay the insurance company. the insurance agent, broker, or producer. But you're going to have to pay the advisor, and you're going to have to look at what he or she wants. Mm-hmm. The cost will be a little bit more disclosed to you, but still there's going to be a cost you have to compare. Your money is tied up for 5 to 10 years, like this gentleman said. So if you're going to need access to that money, you will get usually a 5 to 10% quote-unquote free withdrawal every year from the annuity. But beyond that, you will pay a penalty, and you may pay a market value adjustment on top of that if you close it. So not only will you have usually between a 9 to 3% penalty in whatever year you take it out, you may also have to pay an additional penalty if interest rates rise during the period of time you hold the annuity, and if you cash it in before it matures, they will put what is called a market value adjustment, or essentially, you're taking the risk of rising interest rates at that point. If you hold the annuity to maturity, you won't lose anything. But if you close the annuity during the deferral period, you will pick up the cost of rising interest rates. So keep that in mind, listener. You didn't list market value adjustment as one of the negatives. I would. So I don't have a problem with him doing it, Chris. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. These products are incredibly complex. I don't want to get into them. I think they're okay for some people. They're not for others. Do you have anything you want to share?
Yeah, I will just give my kind of general opinion. We don't know all the specifics about his circumstances, about the financial part of it, or even have talked to him directly to understand his emotional issues regarding volatility or risk. But the cases where I see the strongest evidence that it makes sense to consider one of these things in the application he's describing is where the emotional consequences or the emotional issues of it bothering him to watch volatility or downside potential in some of these funds is an overriding factor, that that's a key issue, because there are these embedded costs and lack of liquidity and all the other things that we talk about on the negative side that have to be overcome with something. And usually if we're looking at just the financial benefits of overcoming those things, it's not a real compelling argument. That's why a lot of people the crunch, the numbers aren't that excited about them, but they're dismissing the emotional benefits of such a product. And so if that's an overriding thing for him, I think it could make sense. And if he's truly believing that he's got an income need down the road, then we have to throw in the even more complex issue of considering an income benefit rider on this annuity, where he has the downside protection, but then maybe some of that is offset by the benefits of some type of guaranteed income base generation that he could then turn on income in the future at an attractive amount, knowing full well that he's given up the liquidity and the potential growth that he could otherwise possibly receive if he didn't bake it into this product. But since he mentioned one of the the future needs he might very well have is income, he'd have to, if he's going to go down this path, he may as well consider all the options and consider that if that's of attraction to him, instead of just using this as a vehicle to then turn around and buy a SPIA potentially in the future. Maybe keep in the back pocket turning on income directly from this annuity if it makes sense at the time, knowing that he wouldn't have to. It's just an option for him. Now, he's going to pay for that option, of, as you know, better than most people, right? There's a cost to this. Every time you add a feature that could benefit you to one of these insurance products, none of it comes for free. The insurance company isn't a beneficial organization. They're in it to make money. They'll offer you benefits for a fee, for a cost. So it just adds to the complexity and cost of these things if you go down that road. But it'd be worth considering since he mentioned income specifically.
Okay. A couple of things that I do want to point out before we wrap that up with. First, there are as many fixed indexed annuities, they're probably stars in the galaxy.
Yeah.
There are some that are real crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. And there's others that are pretty darn good. And we have used these types of annuities in the past for people.
On occasion.
On occasion.
It's not very common.
It's not all the time, but no. We have used them in the past. Be very careful when you go to buy one. Because the person selling them to you, for the most part, is going to earn a commission and gets paid to put you in them. I attended an online class a couple weeks ago, being given by an annuity wholesaling firm that had sent me a marketing email. I can't remember exactly what the email said, but it kind of pissed me off. It disgusted me when I read it.
That made you want to sit in on the presentation?
I wanted to see the BS they were pushing.
Yeah.
And it was talking about how this person sold an $800,000 annuity and didn't even know what she was doing and how they can help you and all the money you can make and how you can do it while still offering Medicare plans to your clients. I was just disgusted with everything in there. So I thought, I'm going to sit in here and see how these bozos are doing this. And I took copious amounts of notes, folks, and I wrote some direct quotes that were being spoon-fed to us and how this company, this wholesaling company, was pushing the annuities they were pushing. And the one annuity that they were really pushing that people should consider, I researched the company, and they were a B-rated insurance company pushing a bonus annuity. Whenever you see the word bonus, just change it, folks, to bogus. Because that's what it is. A bonus is just a hook that the insurance company is trying to use to reel you in. But a bonus is bogus. It's pure BS. And even the insurance company has to disclose that bonus annuities generally have higher fees, lower cap rates, which is a way of saying they pay less interest and they charge more.
You're paying for your own bonus.
Exactly. You're paying for it, folks. The point is, attending that seminar, and I haven't had a chance yet to put my notes together and figure out what I want to talk about. It'll be on an EDU show. Just to get you, and most people listening to this podcast are way too smart to fall victim to that. They're going after, not you, no one listening to this podcast, I don't think, would ever fall victim to a B-rated insurance company's bogus annuity that they're trying to sell you with a 10-year penalty period and market value adjustment and all this other crap built into it. You wouldn't fall victim to it, but people do. So watch out when you go to buy these. You have to really trust. There are some really good fixed indexed annuities out there from some really good companies, and I would like them and would use them. And folks, as interest rates have been rising, I've been keeping my eyes on some from the companies I like. Why? They're getting potential interest crediting, Chris, not on the broker sold one, but on the advisor sold ones. In other words, the ones that don't pay me one red cent to put you in them, they're getting cap rates now at 7.5%. They're getting up there pretty high. I'm getting intrigued by them. Just be careful with who you buy them from and be very careful if they push on you a bonus annuity. Just change the word bonus to bogus, and then every time they say bonus, say bogus. And if it still sounds good at the end of that, then okay. But chances are if you change the word to bogus, you're going to be, wait a minute, this isn't good. I'm not going to do this. That's the first thing that I want to mention. Just kind of be careful when you go and purchase them.
And I do want to point out, you said you warned people and then said they're going to get a commission. There's nothing wrong with the person you're dealing with earning a commission.
Nope.
But it tends to create the real potential for a conflict of interest in what they're telling you. They are a salesperson selling you something for a commission. And as we all know, in every industry where there's salespeople earning commissions, and there's a whole bunch of them out there, there's perfectly good salespeople that aren't going to try to pull the wool over your eyes, aren't going to try to make something sound better than it really is, and are upstanding and respectable to deal with. insurance agents that earn a commission, there's a bunch of those out there, perfectly respectable, do the right thing kind of people. But there's also those who are attracted to nothing more than the commission. That's the whole reason they're there. They couldn't care less about helping you, really. It's all about convincing you to buy it, you know, no matter what, so they can earn that commission. And these, you know, this thing that Jim attended, a lot of these, it starts at the wholesale level. They talk to people like that's all they're interested in. Here, come listen to how we do this. We'll tell you how to shove this down people's throats and look at all the money you can make. They don't lead it with, hey, look at this great stuff that you can help your clients with, that you can help these people with. Look how good it is for them. No, the whole story is how great it is for the producer. And that just tells you right there what their focus is.
Well, this whole company was playing that whole aspect mm-hmm. up, folks. Mm-hmm. The commission on that product, by the way, was 7.5%. Mm-hmm. The client put $800,000 in, and all what they were touting was how with their process, which helps the insurance agent find one of four issues that a retiree has, and the solution to all those issues, folks, would always be a fixed indexed annuity. Mm-hmm. And the agent, they kept saying, made $60,000
yeah. commission
on this. Mm-hmm. And the agent didn't have to do anything. The wholesaler does it all. The agent takes in on a questionnaire the information, sends it to the wholesaler. They produced a quote-unquote retirement plan, Chris, whose solution just happened to be...
Don't tell me.
Okay, see if you can guess.
Could it have been the annuity was the solution?
It's amazing how that works out.
Oh my gosh.
The solution just happened to be a fixed indexed annuity. I am not bashing all insurance agents, and I have no problem with commissions. I am a licensed insurance producer and do earn insurance commissions on certain insurance policies that we may sell. But I do have an issue with a wholesaling firm who is existing to show people how, in my humble opinion, how to shove a piece of crap equity indexed annuity down unsuspecting people's throats with absolutely no knowledge at all on financial planning. We're talking just a licensed insurance agent who, in my opinion, shouldn't even be talking about an equity index or fixed indexed annuity tied to an equity index because they're not even licensed to sell investments. It just, the whole insurance industry ticks me off on the regulation of the insurance industry. But as Chris rightfully pointed out, there's absolutely nothing wrong with a commission. And please, insurance agents, good ones listening to this, who wouldn't sell a piece of crap annuity through an insurance wholesaler whose entire business model is no matter what your clients have, there's an equity in this annuity that's going to solve it, and we're going to show you how to do it. That was pretty much their business model, Chris. Mm-hmm. You have to equally watch out on these fee-based annuities. Mm-hmm. You got to be careful. Selling a fee-based annuity or buying a fee-based annuity, but then the advisor is going to charge you, what, 1% on it? For what? For managing a fixed indexed annuity? I think that's a crime. There's not much you're doing in that.
Right.
You're not rebalancing. You're not doing anything. Yeah. You're going to buy one of the indexed options and you're going to hold it. And you're going to give them 1%?
Yeah, it's almost like they justify it by saying, we're going to charge you 1% on this because if we hadn't put you in this, you would have still held your assets with me. And I don't want to take the harm of the reduced commission. So I'm going to force you to pay me this 1% commission every year because I let you take this out of your portfolio and put it in this annuity. That's kind of the signal you're sending when you charge like that.
We get over it in our firm because we don't charge on them at all. If you're an investment management client of ours, we have a capped fee structure. Doesn't matter to me if you go in an annuity or stay in an ETF. So that's how we absolve it. But the point I want to mention to this listener and all, pay attention to who you're buying your annuities from. Run from anyone who's pushing bonus because it's bogus as far as I'm concerned. And be very aware of what not only you're paying, what they're going to earn. And pay attention to it. Because again, the incentive to perhaps put you in annuity products that commission more than other annuity products is there. We're not saying every insurance agent is going to fall for that, but I've been in this field for 24 years. I've been an insurance agent or producer in the state of Colorado with producers. I've been a producer for that 24-year period. And so many annuity companies, when they send marketing stuff to me or wholesalers like this wholesale company that I attended, they always lead with the commission, Chris. Mm-hmm. Here is, we've got this, that, and the other thing, and it pays 8%. Or anyone you buy or sell within the next 4 months, we're going to give a bonus of another 0.5% to you, not to, to the agent, mm-hmm. not to you, the person. That just irks the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. So recognize that, folks, that that's out there. All right, let's get to some real other questions. This one's easy. I think you can be able to answer it. Very straightforward. Mm-hmm. Another 5-year question on Roths. Jim and Chris. Oh, excuse me. Chris and Jim. Maybe that's why I'll have you answer it.
Okay.
Cowboy and Bugsy. Chris and Jim. To follow up on the 5-year Roth, to follow up on the 5-year old Roth 401k being moved to Roth IRA question. What about this? A 67-year-old with a new 2021 Roth 401k. Mm-hmm. Later rolls that Roth 401k, Roth 401k, to a Roth IRA before the age of 72 to avoid required minimum distributions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so far so good. No problem there, folks.
So those you don't know, Roth 401ks, even though they're Roth, have required minimum distributions. The distributions are still not taxable because it's Roth, but they do force you to take it out. So a lot of people do. What if you don't need the money, you don't want to take it out, you want to leave it in the Roth wrapper. You're going to roll it out to a Roth IRA to avoid those RMDs. So I just wanted to make sure everybody was on board with that.
Correct. Mm-hmm. The Roth IRA will be 5 years old. Mm-hmm. How does that work for withdrawals of contributions and growth from the Roth IRA? So what she's saying, brand new Roth 401k will be moved to an existing Roth with a that's already 5 years old, how will withdrawals of the growth be treated? I don't want to get to her next sentence. I'll stop there. Mm-hmm. Do you want to attack that one or you want me to?
No, this is a scenario we haven't described before because this one is, you know, one in 10,000 maybe, one in maybe less than that. This would be a very infrequent occurrence for someone to start a Roth 401k so late, but maybe you started working at the very tail end of your career. Maybe they just launched the Roth version of your 401k at your employment right before you were going to retire or something. You're in your late 60s, like this scenario might be. Once the stuff is in the Roth IRA, my understanding, unless Jim's going to pull out some kind of weird one-off rule here, is that now that everything is in there, it's going to be treated as the Roth IRA money, the Roth IRA distributions now being 5 year old, the qualified distributions. So that's just going to be earnings on there would be able to come out tax free as a qualified distribution.
That is true. And then I just was doing the math in my head. She's 67. She started it last year, 2021. So I don't know if she was 66 then. By time she moves it at 72, it'll already be 5 years old itself. But
true.
A couple of things. She's not going to want to move it in the year she turns 72. She's going to want to move it in the
year
she is 71.
Right.
Do not move it in the year you're 72 because you will first have to take the required minimum distribution,
right,
which is what you are trying to avoid.
Right.
It'll be tax-free, but you're still going to have to take it.
Yeah, so be aware that, and this applies to IRAs as well, when there's an RMD due, that RMD becomes due and payable or due and distributable as of midnight in the morning on the 1st of January of that year that you're required to take it. Just because you end up taking it later doesn't mean it's not due. So that's what Jim's talking about. If you wait until the year you turn 72, January 1st in the morning at midnight, right, 12:01 a.m., that RMD is due and is going to be the first dollars that come out of there, whether you like it or not. So that's what he's recommending you avoid.
Right, and RMDs,
getting it out beforehand.
RMDs can never be
rolled over.
So that's why you have to take them first out of the 401k. So she's not going to have an issue, but let's just take it one step further. What if she opened the Roth 401k in 2021, which she did, and now it's 2022, and she wants to move it to a Roth IRA that's already 5 years old, and let's just assume for the sake of argument, folks, she put $10,000 into the Roth 401k, and magically it's worth $20,000. Let's ignore the market volatility and all that. And she's essentially asking, if I move this Roth 401k into my Roth IRA, would I still be able to access that growth tax free? I am over the age of 55 and 59 and a half, and my Roth IRA is already 5 years old, so I qualify to take growth out. But my 401k, Roth 401k that I'm moving, yes, I'm over 59 and a half, I'm 67, but my Roth 401k is not 5 years old. That's okay. The Roth IRA is, and that Roth 401k money will be shielded by the Roth IRA.
Yeah, it'll essentially inherit it as it goes in. So it's a, in one case, it inherits the seasoning from the 401k when it will benefit you, but it never goes the other direction. It's not like the 401k being unseasoned. That status will remain inside of a fully seasoned Roth IRA. So it's going to inherit the seasoning. And we say that because we've kind of adopted this whole concept of seasoning or ripening when it comes to funds that might be affected by a five-year rule.
Okay. This next question concerns me because I'm not quite sure what this woman has. I'm hoping she didn't make a mistake somewhere. Says, hello, Chris, and what, another one that begins with you.
Well, maybe it's alphabetical order.
It's the second one. No, it's Jim and Chris, folks, or Bugsy and Cowboy.
No, Chris and Jim's fine.
No,
or
no.
Just Chris.
No. What do you mean just Chris?
Chris and that other guy.
No, that is, no, no. See, this is a true story, folks. A couple of years ago.
Are you sure you want to admit this?
I don't know if it was, if he was being funny or if he honestly couldn't remember your name. Didn't he say Jim, Pete, and the other guy?
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah,
it was that guy. We got an email. I kid you not. I think it was back with Pete. I don't think it was Bob. I think it was Pete, the old estate planning attorney we had. And we got this email, and they write, "Dear Jim and Pete and the other guy." I like that one.
I didn't contribute to that answer.
But anyways, this is a hello, Chris and Jim, or Cowboy and Bugsy with our new call names. You're first. I should make you answer this. Greetings from New York City, exclamation point. So this is a happy New York Cityer. I recently started listening to your show and have been both enjoying and learning a lot. I'm 60. I'm getting to retire in 8 months. Now, remember, folks, I'm in my November pile of 2021, so this person is getting really close to retirement now. Getting ready to retire in 8 months. I have enough money in my tax-deferred 403B and brokerage accounts, about $3.5 million total, to fund my retirement. I also have three inherited variable annuity. Oh, okay, here it is. IRAs. That I didn't see the word IRA after that, so I got worried initially. Three inherited variable annuity IRAs worth a total of $600,000. I own my own home, and I have no debt. I'm a single mother and one child who will be attending college. I need some advice on what to do with these three inherited annuities. Right now, they are liquid and invested in index funds. I am opening to annuitizing them if you think that would be my best plan for retirement. My other investments have about 65-35 allocation, so I'm a little on the aggressive side. I would put that about moderately aggressive. I wouldn't call that aggressive, 65% equities, 35% fixed income. Listen, I put you moderately aggressive. So I don't mind having a safety floor if the market downturns. If you use my question on your show, please call me Carla. She doesn't want to be Georgette.
Oh.
It's not her real name. She gave her real name. She wants to be Carla. So.
Well, let's not. Okay, we'll honor this, but in the future?
Yeah, you can't choose your anime.
We're not going to start.
No.
Yeah. We got a very long history of George and Georgette being our anonymous names, and it's become part of the DNA of the show. So we're going to stick to that. I just don't want people to start picking random names that we're going to call.
Maybe the name Carla means something to her, and she didn't want to be. Maybe she dated a George and she didn't like him.
Maybe. But we're just putting everybody on notice. Here on forward, this is not going to become a common practice. So, Carla, we're more than happy to answer your question.
Okay. Couple of things. I'll let Chris address the planning aspect of having that, perhaps having some income floor. Mm-hmm. What I was panicking on, I didn't see IRA, and I thought inherited annuity, you've got to close them within 5 years of inheriting them unless they came from a spouse. Mm-hmm. So do keep that in mind. When you inherit annuities, even though they are an insurance product designed for retirement and often have a lot of the rules of retirement plans like IRAs, they don't have required minimum distributions. It kind of makes them neat in a sense. But when you die, their distribution rules are far stricter than the distribution rules of inherited IRAs, which, by the way, have been made incredibly complex. And we'll be going over that on future shows. If you inherit an annuity outside of an IRA, and you're not the spouse of the person who died, you really got two choices. Annuitize it within 1 year. Why don't you explain what that means, Chris?
That means you're going to give up claim to the liquidity. You're being able to take lump sum amounts and instead say, insurance company, please keep this. And instead of giving me the lump sum value of this thing right now, pay me income for the rest of my life. Annuitize it. You essentially give up claim to it or change your claim. You now have a claim against the insurance company and the income benefits, the income stream that they're going to promise you if you let them keep the lump sum amount.
Correct. So you can annuitize it into an income stream, which she's willing to do. Mm-hmm. It's the verb. It's an action. You took a noun, an annuity, and turned it into an action, a verb, annuitize. Or you have to close the annuity within 5 years and take all the money out. All growth will be taxed as income, and all return of the decedent's principal will be tax-free. Mm-hmm. Those are your two choices. She has an IRA. The variable annuities are inside the IRA. That gives her a wrapper. Now, listen to you. Don't tell me when you inherited those annuities. I have seen, Chris, when a non-spouse inherits an annuity, even if it's in an IRA wrapper, many of the annuity companies force you to get out of it within 5 years. That's what their systems are set up for, to get you out of that annuity, non-spouse beneficiary, annuitize it or close it within 5 years. They're not in the business, some are, but most aren't, of allowing you to keep the IRA annuity open longer and follow IRA distribution rules. They put you under the annuity distribution rules, which are far stricter. So don't be surprised if that happens. I'm not saying it's going to. I have seen both. I have seen insurance companies that let non-spouse beneficiaries, because it's in the IRA wrapper, treat it like an inherited IRA and follow the distribution rules of inherited IRAs. But I have seen insurance companies say the opposite. We're an insurance company. Our system is set up to close non-spousal inherited annuities within 5 years or annuitize it within one. You can still take the money and move it to an inherited IRA.
Right.
They're just not going to want you to keep it at the annuity company.
Yeah. Yep.
So I'm not sure what boat she falls in. I just wanted to throw that out there, that could be an issue. But your question, listener, you've got $600,000 in inherited annuities that could be turned into an income stream. Mm-hmm. You're wondering if that's a wise thing to do. You've got $3.5 million. You're a recent retiree, a single mother. You seem to be in really good financial situation. You are moderately aggressive on your investments. At least you were back in November. I don't know if you still are today. And you're looking for a little bit of floor. So far, nothing you said bothers me except mm-hmm. for one thing. I don't know if you need the additional income. Right. What do you think, Chris?
Right. There's not nearly enough info here to come to the conclusion that additional income makes sense. Almost for sure, although with the 403B, who knows? But my guess is there's some Social Security out there. If there's not Social Security, there's some kind of other pension likely. She didn't happen to mention it. The reason why I see a 403B, oftentimes that almost always that means there's government work involved or school district work or something like that. And that many times comes in parallel with some kind of pension.
I assume the same thing. She's got a 403B. That's got to be a school, a government, and pension involved.
Right. So if not pension, then Social Security. Well, something's in there. So there's already some secure income probably there in her profile somewhere that she, even though she didn't mention it directly. And that might be sufficient to create the kind of floor that we encourage people to consider. In our process, we like people to define or figure out their minimum dignity floor, which are the five expense categories of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. Do a projection on those. What do I need to cover those in secure income? Look at their current secure income, Social Security and pension and income annuities you already have, and then come to a determination, I'm in good shape, or I might need additional income to cover that minimum dignity floor in particular. It's at that point, if the conclusion is more lifetime secure income is needed, the first place I'd look are those current VAs, right? You already have an annuity product. Let's make sure they won't do the job best for you. Could be a natural fit. Some or all might be used. I suspect that all would be overkill with our process and our approach, because I can't imagine a single person, a single 60-year-old needing to turn more than $600,000 into additional income just to cover the minimum dignity floor above and beyond Social Security or pension. That would be a shock. But it's possible that the analysis could indicate that some of the VA monies that are sitting there would be great used as an income stream instead to create that floor that we encourage people to consider as part of our process. So that's the way we'd look at it. I agree with Jim. We don't know enough in order to say whether you should or shouldn't. All I can say is if you determine you do need more secure income, always consider current annuities you have as well as other annuities that you could obtain to see which one makes sense, which one's going to give you the best benefit. And if these are older VAs, they may very well have annuitization options that beat what you can get from a current brandy new annuity. And so it might be a glorious place to acquire some additional secure income if your plan projections indicate it's needed.
Perfect. Couple quick things on that. You don't tell us when you inherited them. Mm-hmm. If you inherited them just a couple of years ago, the tail end of 2019, say, you might have the old stretch rules and you might not be subject to Secure Act or what could be a 10-year payout if you're not an eligible designated beneficiary. You don't share any of this information with us. So I'm not quite sure, but if you have a stretch ability on that, meaning you can keep it around for your remaining life expectancy, you're 60 now, you might have inherited that when you were 57, 58, you could still have a 20, 25-year quote-unquote stretch. And I would be a little hesitant to tell you to annuitize that. You can keep, you don't have to keep it inside the annuity. You have that IRA wrapper, listener. So you can tell the insurance company, I want to move this inherited IRA that just happens to have an annuity in it. I want to move it to my own inherited IRA over here at this custodian. And that would allow you to treat it more as a quote-unquote regular inherited IRA, if you will, listener. And if you have a 20, 25, 28-year-old stretch on it, you might want to keep that. It's just I'm thinking out loud. I don't know. I don't know enough about you. So do keep that in mind, that you will have that ability to do. What I don't know, Chris, and I'm struggling on, is what if it wasn't? What if she inherited it after secure? And let's just assume the insurance company isn't going to force her to close it within 5 years, which if they did, listen, and no problem, move it to an inherited IRA for another 5 years. But if it's post-secure, she's got to close it within 10 years. She didn't annuitize it within the first year of death. So I don't know if she would...
Do we know that for sure?
Well, I'm just assuming she inherited it more than a year ago, but maybe she didn't. What I don't know, and gosh, I should know this. I'm almost embarrassed to say I don't know the answer to this. Can you take an inherited, essentially an IRA that just happens to have an annuity in it, and under the 10-year rule, can you annuitize it, the account, into a lifetime payout? I think you can, and I think that would satisfy.
I think you can.
Yes.
But that's an interesting question, because we've always talked about the quote new 10-year rule as part of the SECURE Act, that all these other variations, but we haven't addressed that directly. But always the rule has been, if you annuitize, those annuity payments become the RMD. It overrides the normal RMD requirements for that particular account. So if that holds true still...
But the government is explicit. You have to annuitize within the first year of death. And that's where I think they got you. You follow what I'm saying? They want the money out of the IRA. They don't want to stretch it. That's a way of creating almost a backdoor stretch. I inherited this IRA. I'm going to keep it around under the 10-year rule. And in year nine, I'm going to annuitize it. I don't think you can do that. But you might not be able to annuitize it, is what I'm telling you, listener. I will find out. I'm 99% sure you got to get it within that first year so you don't manipulate the system. In the first year, I think you could have annuitized it. I don't know if you're going to be allowed to annuitize it after that first year. And that's what I'm not sure of, because think about it, listeners. I think if you could do it, that strategy would be out there, that, hey, you want the stretch, no big deal under the 10-year thing. Keep it for 9 years, and in year 10, when you're supposed to empty it, annuitize it, and annuitize it over your life expectancy. I'm not prepared to say you can't do it, but I honestly am not sure, but my gut tells me you can't. If anybody listening to this is in the insurance industry and knows the answer to that, let me know, but I'll have it by next week. But do you understand what I'm trying to describe? Yeah. I just don't know. I know the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code, is pretty explicit on non-qualified inherited annuities. They got to be annuitized within the first year, or they have to be closed by year 5. There's no rule that says if you don't annuitize it the first year, go ahead and annuitize it in year 4 before we want it all out in year 5.
Yeah. But those are non-qual.
Those are non-qual. Mm-hmm. So my gut tells me you are not going to be able to do that, to annuitize that variable annuity, because it's in the IRA wrapper and you might have missed year 1.
She kind of, doesn't she claim she can though? So maybe she's already checked into it and she can.
She might have been told by the insurance company you can't. She doesn't indicate at all that it's within the year. She didn't say I just inherited. So I don't know. If it's within the first year, listener, yes, you can annuitize it. And if you feel the annuitization rates are good, you want that floor, as you said, of secure income, you have the first year to do it. It's after that first year, I don't think you can. And that's what I'm not sure of.
Okay. The good news is that 403B she has almost certainly has annuitization options. And even if it doesn't, she's got other ways.
She's got $3.5 million.
Yeah, she's got other ways. So it's not like this is sunk, but this is, I guess, the comment that, you know, she thinks she could generate income from this could be a little more nuanced as the opportunities for that. But you've posed an excellent question that we need to get an answer to, since we strive to know the answer to practically everything when at all possible. But here's a hole we have to admit to. I don't know the answer, and Jim doesn't know the answer off the top of our heads. So we'll have to look at that.
My gut tells me it's no, but I'll find out. And the Ed Slot Group, oh, they hate annuity questions. Because they're specialists in IRAs, not annuities. And every time I hit them with annuity questions, oh, they get so they get wicked annoyed at me. So I will.
But it's inside an IRA, so they have to deal with it.
Anyways, listener and listeners in general, Chris and I are big believers in secure income. The fact that this is an annuity she inherited is immaterial. She has $3.5 million plus another $600,000 she invested, even if it wasn't in an annuity. You can annuitize at any time if you like that security or if you need the secure income. So we're not either pro or anti-annuitization. If you listen to us long enough, you know we believe in annuitization for minimum dignity floor items. But if you want to go beyond that, that's a personal decision. Who are we to say it's wrong? If it makes you feel good, as Chris said, from an emotional standpoint, then it's a wonderful thing. And I say you can do it if you want. And we'll find out on the next show, hopefully, if the Ed Slot Group doesn't disown me, and find out. But my gut tells me no, because that would be an easy way around the 10-year rule and to add a stretch.
True.
I know insurance companies all the time say the stretch isn't dead. Buy an annuity. Because you can mandate at death, the beneficiary must annuitize as the payout option. And then the beneficiary has to annuitize within 1 year and gets the payments over the course of their life.
Right.
So it's a way of forcing a stretch. So I know you can do it within the first year. It's the subsequent years, I don't know.
Well, I look forward to hearing the answer to that.
I'll find out.
Perfect.
All right, that's about it.
Yep. So thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us for another Q&A show. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, if you want to send in your own questions, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com, and put in the subject line question for the podcast. Even though we are going through questions from back in November, December of 21 at this point, as we record this in April of 2022, we still do pluck out at least one question of the week where that just came in this week. So don't give up hope that you can't possibly get your question answered. If it's a really sweet question, you might rise to the top and get answered immediately here on the show.
Or if it's a very slow week, you might be the only new question of the week.
That's true. You know, you got no chance unless you try.
We had one of those already since doing this. It was the only question I got, so it became question of the week.
Perfect. So we can only do this show if we get your questions, so we really do appreciate you sending them in, even though many of them may not be timely. But we go through so many different questions on different topics, hopefully. If we don't answer yours, we'll answer something similar. So you get your answers one way or the other. And if you get bored and you're new, you can go back and listen to the whole history of these shows. And maybe your question is embedded in one of the hundreds and hundreds of these shows that we've done over time. We really do appreciate you as listeners. Jim, you have a nice, it's almost weekend time. People are going to be hearing this on the weekend because this will drop on Saturday morning. So,
cool.
I'll let you go.
I will talk to you next week.
Sounds good. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.